From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show. Yeah, buddy. All right, it's Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your host, John, along with my co-host, Stuart, in Australia. Say hi, Stu.
Hi, Stu.
Very good. No Hunter tonight. He is either on a week-long celebration of his birthday, which he is known to do, or he has the flu. It's one or the other. You choose your own reality with that. Tonight we have a very special guest. I've been wanting to get him on for a while, and now he's got the time for us. You know, in the 90s, there was this sort of direct-to-video movie boom of movies inspired by Kickboxer and Bloodsport and the Steven Seagal movies. And a lot of these films were made in the Philippines, some in Thailand. Even some Hong Kong talent would make these films under anglicized names. You know, and one real talent, when you go back and watch these films, like Bloodsport 2, that stands out, guy who's got all the moves, he moves like a Shaw Brothers actor in the 70s, like a Venom or something. A lot of acrobatics, pretty sharp martial arts skill, but, you know, should be one of the bigger names in the Hollywood martial arts industry, but that's kind of a strange thing that we're going to get into. Tonight, our guest is actor, stuntman, choreographer, Ron Hall. Hi, Ron.
Hello, John.
Hey, it's good to have you on. I just thought I'd let you give a little short biography of yourself, how you got into the movie industry, why you wanted to get into Hollywood, what you thought the best road was, you know, the usual setup.
Sure. I'm from Washington, D.C. I moved to Hollywood in 1991 to work in martial art action movies. I've loved martial art action movies my entire life. I would say I'm probably one of the few guys in that era that really loved martial art movies, as when I was trying to do the type of action I was trying to do, which is actually common today, people would tell me, no, America would never go for the Hong Kong style action.
Yeah.
And how I got into movies, actually, Eric Lee, who's a martial art actor and fight choreographer, actually gave me my first role in the film Deadly Bet. So that was the first movie that I ever did. After that, I made a demo tape and I went to the American Film Market and I couldn't afford to get into it. So I waited till it was closed. And I took 15 of my demos and stuck it out in front of the doors. And the next morning, three movie companies called me. One of them was Davian Films that I ended up doing three films for. And one of the people were Mark DeSalle, who had produced the movies with Van Damme and Jeff Speakman.
Yeah. Yeah, worked for Kings Road, right? Wasn't that his company or something? I think he did products.
Well, I think he had a co-production deal. He actually, at the time that I signed with Mark, he was with Paramount. He had done a movie. He had already done Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman, and he was finishing Street Night when I met him.
Okay. Yeah, and Street Night, strangely, went over to Warner Brothers, it was like a Canon Warner Brothers joint, which didn't make much sense because I'd heard Speakman had signed this three-picture deal with Paramount, and then he's doing Street Night over with another studio. So I was like, what's going on there?
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion going on at that time, because actually Mark had created a project for me called Home Turf that was supposed to be directed by Albert McNulty, who did Purple Rain.
Right, and the ghost-directed Tango and Cash, I think, was one of the legends about him. Without credit, because he had to finish it, because I guess the first director they hired who gets the credit couldn't finish the film.
Sure. So, yeah, so he was involved with a lot of different companies at that time.
Right. Wow. So what happened with Home Turf? Did they just decide we got to make more movies in the Philippines, or the production deals took everything all around? I always hear about really good projects that never seem to happen for some reason.
Right. Well, when I had signed with Mark DeSalle, he had already had Van Damme and Jeff Speakman. And one of the things that he had told me, he said, hey, Ron, you know, he said, like, Van Damme audience is primarily an African-American audience, the people that go to see Van Damme's movies. And he was like, you know, you have kicking skills of like a Van Damme, and you got the hand skills of a Jeff Speakman, and you can do two things that neither of them can do, which are acrobatics and weapons. And you're a black guy. So we're certain that we can market you toward a black audience, the same audience for Van Damme. But what ended up happening was when he was developing a project with me, at that time, martial art movies weren't like they are now. They weren't A-list films or, you know, like big Hollywood films. They were all independent, low-budget productions. So it was kind of hard for him to convince. You know, at that time, I had done only one movie, which was Triple Impact. And it was hard for him to convince people that this unknown black martial artist could headline movies. So he had a he had a difficult time with that. And he actually sold my contract to a company in Florida that I went to live in Miami for about 6 months to make a movie called In the Mix that never came about. So, you know, So it was a very, different, it was just an interesting period that I was going from one place to the other to do films that I never did.
Right. And people forget the market was very different back then. There was a huge emphasis on direct-to-video product. And because I remember, like, you were in Bloodsport 2, and Bloodsport 2, I believe, was a mostly a direct-to-video thing, although I think a lot of these films do play theaters in certain markets, like in foreign markets. But, you know, nowadays it wouldn't happen. I think everybody around the world is watching the same thing, Marvel movies and, you know, whatever comedies they can export over to those countries. But you mentioned Triple Impact. I actually watched that in prep for this show. And it was interesting because it was you and Dale. Was it Dale Apollo Cook? Was the and Bridget Baby Doll Riley, both of whom were kickboxing champs. And you're a guy with these, like, you've got just amazing cinematic skills. Was there any, like, did either of those two have any issues like exaggerating their moves for the camera, or, you know, trying not to be too realistic on film? Because people forget you got to be real elaborate with your moves so the camera can see what you're doing. It's not really like real fighting when you're watching a UFC or something and you can barely see the punches and kicks. So,
well, actually, Dale, being a kickboxer at that time, he actually was very good doing his style of fighting on film. Right. I mean, you know, we would do the choreography and stuff. He was very fluid and very energetic. And I was actually surprised that I found his fights as entertaining as they ended up being, because there are a lot of examples of kickboxer guys that, while they may have been good fighters, when it came to cinematic fighting, their fighting was, like, not entertaining or, you know.
Yeah, it's different, predictable, I guess.
Right. But I will say that there was a thing that Dale would always say, that Ron Hall is a movie fighter. You know, that was people say that to me all the time. It's like, I'm not a real fighter because I fight in movies. People would always go, Ron Hall's a movie fighter.
Right.
So
and I noticed they allowed you to do a lot of cool, like, acrobatic moves and basically not the typical what you would call American stuff. And then I looked at the credits and they say it's the director is David Hung as David Hunt. Was David Hung a Chinese filmmaker, or, because I know IMDb gets these bios mixed up, so I don't know what to trust.
Yeah, David Hung was a Chinese filmmaker. He's done a lot of movies. He's actually, I don't know if you remember the movies Cleopatra Wong.
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, he was the cinematographer on those movies. And he did a couple other movies in the Philippines with, what's the guy named? Bobby Suarez.
Yeah. It's like a lot of
Mr. Hung. Yeah, so Mr. Hung was the cinematographer first before he became a producer. And, Mr. Hung, one thing that has been interesting in my entire career of doing movies is the type of action that I wanted to do, people always, like, tried to keep me from doing it. People would always say, well, Ron, you're too kung fu-y. And I grew up watching, you know, Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Shaw Brothers, and that's how I wanted to express myself, is that I wanted to bring the same dynamics that I thought, you know, speed, power, agility, and have it entertaining, and also have it in a fighting context. You know, a lot of times people will say that my fighting is too, too acrobatic or something like that. But I will say that if you look at my action, even if I use a lot of acrobats, I still will make the context as if I'm really fighting. It doesn't look like I'm just moving around for no reason at all.
Right, because so, that always annoyed me about, like, not to slam Shokasugi, but in some of his ninja movies, they kind of just do the flips for no reason. Like, they're flipping away or whatever. It doesn't have any context to the fight. They just seem to be doing flips. And then I've seen, oddly enough, B. Takashi's Zatoichi film, which I didn't care much for. I had ninjas flipping for no reason. So I was like, oh, great. Now it's had this negative influence on everything. Yeah, but it's like, when you see, like, and for the listeners, I'll explain, like, if you watch Enter the Dragon, where Bob Wall grabs Bruce's foot, and then he does the backflip, kicking Bob Wall in the jaw, which is actually Yuen Hua doing that backflip, it's like, that actually has a context to the acrobatics, which isn't always, like, with the canon films. And yeah, I notice when you're doing your acrobatics, it looks like, well, there's a kick at the end of this, there's a punch, it actually means something. And that's what a lot of them forget. And I also, there's something about American audiences and why Hollywood had this sort of weird anti-Hong Kong choreography prejudice. It's like, for some reason, like, American audiences demand that fights be realistic, which I've never really understood, because it's a movie and gunfights certainly aren't realistic when you watch those in movies. So I think that may have led to some of that mindset right there.
Yeah, well, while people talk about realism, like, let's take Bruce Lee, for example. Like, we all, you know, celebrate Bruce Lee as being, you know, probably the greatest martial artist of all time. However, he probably couldn't go in a room and beat up 50 men untouched.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I always laughed about that. He brought reality to the genre, but he's one man beating up 50 of Han's guards. How is this realistic?
You know? So there was nothing really realistic about it, but what it was is that he presented it in a way in which you accepted that he could do that, meaning that, you know, the dynamics of his, you know, his physicality, his movements, his fighting, you gave him a pass and said, okay, if a guy's this good and can do these things, he probably could do that. But it's really not realism. It's all, you know, it's all choreography for entertainment in a fighting context.
Right.
So, but I think the difference between American audiences and American and Eastern audiences is that American audiences are into impact. What happens at the end of a technique? That's why you can have loads of movies that come out of Hollywood and you never clearly see the technique, but you'll see the impact.
Right.
You see the person getting punched in the face or the person kicked in the face. You may not see how the kick is done. You may not see how the hit is done. Whereas Eastern audiences, their culture is in the fighting. So they have an appreciation for the movement toward the impact. So that's why when we look at things like Shaw Brothers films, we see the techniques, the tiger style, crane style, Charlie Foot, Hungar, all these things, and people marvel in the movement before the impact. So I think that's the difference between American audiences. But I don't think the difference in realism is, I think people like to call it realistic because, you know, everybody can be identified with being hit in the face. Everyone can't identify with a tiger strike to the throat.
Yeah, or snake fist versus, you know, drunken monkey. Or that's sort of, it's almost like, well, I mean, that all changed with The Matrix. I think people are more accepting of it now. And Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, they're more open to it. So I was surprised when I watched The Man with the Iron Fist, the RZA's tribute, and the film was just gore and, like, wirework stuff. There was no kung fu in the film that I could see. And then somebody had told me, who knows, he said, oh, yeah, they cut all the kung fu out, and we shot enough for two films. But they just decided that's not what American audiences wanted to see, which sounds crazy to me, but that mentality is still there.
Well, I think American audiences want to see what's good and entertaining. I mean, you know, there was a time where people said American audiences didn't want to see Jackie Chan, you know?
Yeah.
And so it just depends on, you know, how well you make it. And I think in, you know, while America now has adapted a lot of the techniques of Hong Kong films, you know, primarily you said The Matrix was like the gateway drug, probably one of the first big budget A films that put martial arts on Front Street in front of the American audience.
Yeah, it was very in their face.
Right. And so it became like this thing that martial arts rose from being like bottom basement bargain entertainment to top level A-list Hollywood entertainment. I mean, if you look at now, martial art primarily drives the Hollywood box office. If you take any large action movie, it has martial arts in it in some form. Tom Cruise, Matt Damon, Denzel Washington, all these A-list actors are doing martial arts in movies, and martial arts is the attraction to get people to go see the movie.
Yeah. You were saying, Stu?
I've got a question for Ron.
Sure.
I want to jump over to the stuntman side of your career and ask you if you've ever worked with or been under the tutelage of Buddy Joe Hooker.
No, I have not. I've never met him. No.
Never met him. Okay. Because it seems like he's pretty much considered one of the world's greatest stuntmen of all time. And I assume like everybody's worked with him or at least met him in some capacity somewhere along the way. So, all right. That nixes that question. That's all. I'm a big fan of Buddy Joe Hooker's. That's all. I think he's brilliant. Yeah,
I saw him accept a lifetime award at the Action Fest in Nashville.
They should name a damn award after him. He's just
And here's the thing about a lot of stuntmen. They just don't seem to have any ego. He's like, I don't deserve this, and there's other guys in the biz who deserve this more than me. They just
you really think they would, considering they're literally putting their life on the line. And
yeah, I know, but they really, you know, the few I met don't have like these gigantic egos. They're almost like they're the opposite of what Lee Majors was in The Fall Guy. You know, they're just like. They're very humble, and like, you know, there's plenty of guys better than me that can do this or whatever. So,
well, I guess they're very grounded, aren't they?
Oh yeah, but yeah, Buddy Joe's work.
That was a bad joke.
Everything, Buddy's work. I mean, it's stunning going back. Even on the Australian film, The Odd Angry Shot, they illegally brought Buddy Joe into the country to work on the film.
Really, I didn't know that one. Okay,
yeah, very true.
Okay, what's some of the more dangerous stunts you have done over time there, Ron?
I don't think I've really done any dangerous stunt. I mean, you know, it's kind of like fighting and choreography in films is to make it look dangerous while being in complete control of what you're doing. You know, so it's kind of like a magic trick. Okay. So, you know, I've never had any major injury on a film. I might have done like, you know, like I think the backflip you was talking about in Bloodsport 2. I think I did like about 20 of those before we got a really good one that we could use on film. You know, you know, I've never done anything like, you know, any high falls, anything like that. All the stunt work that I've done in films have been martial art action based, within a fighting context. Yeah.
So not literally jumping out of a fourth story window or something like that.
Right. No, I've never done that.
Okay. Wouldn't do it either.
I'd probably do it. I mean, you know,
Yeah, want to be a big fat paycheck at the end of it, I'll tell you.
But no. Now you worked at Bloodsport 2. Any stories about working on that? I know that Daniel Bernhardt, they were pushing at one time to be like the next Van Damme. And he had the looks and seemed to have a screen presence, but I don't know what was going on with the business at the time. Because there's a lot of guys who I thought should have been bigger and never were.
Yeah. Daniel was a good martial artist. And actually, I think, you know, in terms of... you know, his fighting ability, I believe he was on par and in some ways superior to Van Damme. I mean, Van Damme, I think, had a very unique thing that he came at that time. You know, people till today, you can find, you know, myriad of people putting pictures up with splits and things like that. So Van Damme was a unique talent when he came out. But I think Daniel emerged to be a talent in his own right. So, Daniel was okay. Yeah.
And I think he wasn't a villain in one of the Matrix movies? I know he did a role in.
Yes, he was a villain in the second Matrix movie.
Okay, yeah, okay. Exactly. And now I notice on your IMDb there's something called a Dolomite Explosion, and there's a clip on YouTube of you as Black Chin Ho doing some very Chinese Hong Kong style moves on film. What exactly was the Dolomite Explosion?
Well, the Dolomite Explosion was Rudy Ray Moore's last movie. What happened is, I want to say maybe around 2000, a friend of mine, Steve Tartaglia, they were shooting a scene from Dolomite's movie, and he invited me down there to do some stunts. And I think Roberto Lopez, who was in Once Upon a Time in China in America, and he also did a movie with Robert Tai called I think Trinity Goes East. Are you familiar with any of those films?
Yeah, I have seen Trinity Goes East.
So Roberto Lopez, who's an excellent martial artist, I mean, he really is just a phenomenal martial artist. They had all invited me to be part of their thing that they were shooting with Dolomite. So I actually got to meet Dolomite at that time. And, you know, Rudy Ray Moore to me was like just as important as Bruce Lee. I remember being a kid going to see The Human Tornado, and it blew my mind. I mean, it just blew my mind, you know, seeing where he jumped out the window and said, you know, let me back up and do that again. I mean, it just blew my mind. So to work with him, it was just like fantastic. So what happened was I was actually trying to make my own movie at that time, a Kung Fu Western flick. And I asked him, you know, maybe we could work together on a project. He gave me his home number and we kept in contact over the years. And when I was to do a movie called Vampire Assassin, which I wrote, direct, was in it, fight choreography, I actually called him and asked him, did he want to be in it? And he said, yeah. So he came down there and, you know, I shot some scenes with him and he liked what I was doing. And then he asked me to finish directing. He had been working on this movie for about maybe 5 or 6 years, but he never finished it. So then he asked me to finish working on his movie. So I finished, I actually finished making his movie, and we actually shot some scenes that, you know, unfortunately, no one knows where these scenes are now, but it was really some crazy classic Dolomite stuff. I mean, it was just really insane. And, you know, and Rudy Ray Moore, you know, my relationship, if I had to describe my relationship with Rudy Ray Moore, I think it was perfectly depicted in the movie Ed Wood. Me as Ed Wood and Rudy Ray Moore as Bela Lugosi.
Wow.
Rudy Ray Moore was, I say he was like my father, my brother, my best friend, and my worst enemy.
But Rudy wasn't a dope fiend like Bela Lugosi was, right?
No. Rudy Ray Moore was really a genius. And I'm going to tell you what was an interesting thing that happened to me was, when I first began working on this movie, I had all these ideas. I researched his movies, read all these articles, had all these ideas of what I wanted to do with him. And, you know, he started telling me about his work and his approach to it. And I just really sat back and listened to, like, the wealth of knowledge this guy had about how to present himself and what he wanted to do. And when I accepted what it is that he knew about the character Dolomite and how to present it, It just became like so easy to work with him, because Rudy Ray Moore created this character Dolomite, and we would have these conversations all the time about, he would go, Ron, if it wasn't for Dolomite, I don't know what I would be doing. You know, and he really was a genius. He really knew that character and just, you know, what made that character work. And I loved Rudy. Rudy really, like I said, he was my father, brother, best friend, mortal enemy. And me and him had a wonderful relationship. I think the last time I spoke to Rudy was the day before he died. And I can remember him telling me, you know, he wanted Dolomite Explosion to be like his going away movie. You know, he said, Ron, I just want one more go round. No, but Rudy was really a great guy. And hopefully one day I will make a true Dolomite movie, because when working with him, I learned what he did to make Dolomite movies. I mean, really, he taught me, and aside from how the movies look and how they appear, there's some method to his madness. He really was a genius in terms of the type of movie that he did. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you consider a film like Black Dynamite to be sort of an homage to the Dolomite films of the time?
Yes. I would say so. Because I think he had the one character who was, I can't remember his name, but it was played by the actor Byron Mims or something.
Yeah.
He was like a Dolomite type character, but definitely.
Yeah.
I think it was, you know, it was probably a little bit more sophisticated than a Dolomite movie. And I think Black Dynamite is actually an excellent thing in its own self. I mean, especially that cartoon is really brilliant.
Well, the animated, I thought the animated was much funnier than the movie. I enjoyed the movie, but the animated series was just off the chain funny, because they could just do whatever they wanted being in animated form.
Right. I think if they took some of the elements from the anime and popped it in a movie, they would have something super. But I like Black Dynamite. And I think it was, you know, a lot of that stuff was influenced by Rudy. And Rudy was, I mean, you know, when I was with Rudy, I got to meet a lot of people like, you know, Jamie Foxx was just a huge Rudy fan, you know, Dice Clay. I mean, just tons of people loved Rudy and gave him his respect. And he, you know, he was a, you know, he was just an interesting person and a wonderful human being. And he really loved working in cinema. I can remember one time he had invited me to a show down in L.A. And I don't know how old he was at the time. I know he was in his early 80s. But it was almost, if you can imagine a guy almost looking like he was about to die right there, meaning that he was like kind of shriveled up. He was just kind of walking really, you know, almost like he couldn't walk. And he was like that all the way till he got on. When he got on stage, he was like a 20-year-old man. He literally just bounced back and forth. He was the energy. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Rudy Ray Moore really was a special talent, and I wish that you know, the forces could have pulled together and made his last movie, you know, something special before he died. But there were too many hands in the, you know, in the kitchen, and just, you know, it ended up being what it, you know, ended up being.
Well, it's more so the fact that you wish that people just give him the recognition he deserves, because a lot of people just tend to say, oh, it's Red Fox. Richard Pryor and Red Fox are the ones who influenced my comedy. But you see a lot of Rudy Ray Moore's comedy styling in a lot of comedians these days. The Wayans Brothers is obvious when you watch their stuff. They're heavily influenced by Rudy Ray Moore.
Yeah, you know,
and what's and they've openly said it as well.
Here's an interesting thing is, you know, a couple of years ago, they had this thing, the Kings of Comedy, with, I think it was Dale Hughley, Cedric Anderson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rudy hated that. He hated that. He used to go, I can't believe that they call themselves the Kings of Comedy, and they don't mention me or Red Fox or Richard Pryor and that. Oh, man, that used to burn. I mean, that was the one. That was like his pet peeve. Anytime he would hear Kings of Comedy, oh, man, he would just go on about.
The Kings of Comedy as marketed to millennials, you know, the under 25, the under 30 crowd.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I mentioned names of Rudy Ray Moore, Red Fox, even Richard Pryor to people under 30, they'll go, who the hell's that? So it's all the mark. I don't think it's generally the title, the Kings of Comedy, because D.L. Hughley's, well, you know, he's okay, but he's no Red Fox, that's for sure. So it's just more a marketing playing.
Oh, yeah, I know that. You know, that, but I'm just saying that was the way Rudy took it. Rudy took it as though it was like an affront to him and his contribution because, you know, Rudy, like I said, you know, he was a blues singer. He had a lot of talents. Rudy really was a special man. You know,
but what hurt Rudy Ray Moore is the fact that, let's call it for what it is, the Dolomite movies, the look of them is cheap. It's really cheap. Yeah. So they're instantly dismissed as just, oh, those cheap and nasty flicks that, you know.
Yeah, they don't know how hard he worked on those and how those were made for almost nothing. Like,
what it was, Rudy came to Hollywood to get into movies. He actually was here as a comedian and he wanted to get into movies. And everybody was like, oh, you're too old, you're too heavy, you're too this, you're too that. He was like, fuck them. I'm going to go, you know, make my own movie and make the movie I want to be in, and he did it, you know, and he did it his way, and he said he didn't know what he was doing, and, you know, the mic's hanging from the screen, but he said he created.
And the thing is, well, like, as you were saying before, Ron, Rudy Ray Moore did his own stunts, and to be a stuntman, you've got to kind of be in good shape, and Rudy was not in good shape at all, but he didn't give a shit. It's like, I'm doing my own stunts. It's me.
I love his sidekicks when he's kicking people. They go about knee high.
I love his kicks when the kicks obviously miss the target by about 2 feet, but they still recall back like they've been whacked with the feet of dolomite. It's just
Well, he'd have Howard Jackson in his movies to do some real good looking karate. You know, when Rudy wasn't fighting, it was Howard like throwing kicks around and stuff. Howard Jackson was a kickboxing champ who I think was later Chuck Norris's personal bodyguard for years. Like he was actually a bad dude.
There's a person I'd like to ask about, Chuck Norris. Have you ever worked with Chuck Norris?
No, I've never worked with Chuck Norris.
Oh, he's a hero of mine. That's all. Who are some of the bigger names that you've worked with that we would instantly know about?
Who's a big name that I've worked with? Well, I haven't really worked with any big names. I mean, I've worked with people, you know, in the genre, like, I can't even think of anybody right this second.
Okay, what about directors then that you, you know, sort of B grade directors like a Sheldon Liddich?
No, what was interesting was when we had a screening of Bloodsport 2 when it first came out, actually, Sheldon. Doing that movie, like, people were coming to me going, oh, Ron, like, your performance in this movie is great. You know, your career is going to take off, blah, blah, blah. Let me put you in a movie. And Sheldon actually was one of those people. He was like, Ron, I want to put you in a movie. But, you know, we never worked together. I would say it was interesting. A lot of Asian filmmakers actually had developed relationships with and who had tried to put me in films. Like, Frankie Chan actually offered me a 3-picture contract. But at that time, Paramount, Mark DeSalle was offering me a contract, which was more money, better conditions in the United States. And so I actually took his deal instead of Frankie Chan's deal. And Frankie's goal, like, one thing about Frankie, he wanted to put me in a movie with Jackie Chan. You know, he was like, Ron, you know, I think you're, you know, great. And my goal is to make a movie with you and Jackie in it together. But that never happened. And then Chen Kwan Tai from Shaw Brothers. Chen Kwan Tai. One night I was late at home. I want to say that maybe this was around 1997. I was just up at home one night, and somebody called my house and said, I'm going to speak to Ron Hall. And I was like, this is Ron. He's like, oh, my name's Kerry Chan, and my father, wants to work with you. And he told me to give you a call. And I'm going, Kerry Chan, who is that? And she said, oh, my father's name, Chen Kwan Tai. And I was like, Chen Kwan Tai. I was like, oh, my God, Chen Kwan Tai? And he was like, yeah. So you put him on the phone. And he actually came here for about a year. He lived in the States. And he was trying to put together a project called Dragon Seed. And it was like me. And he was trying to get two of the actors that he was trying to get at the time was he was trying to get Chris O'Donnell and Jennifer Lopez. And he was having meetings with Warner Brothers. And, you know, he stayed here. Like I said, he stayed here for about a year. Yeah. And he would always say to me, he said, Ron, your kung fu is pretty good. Like, he would look at me and smile and hold up his thumb, and he would go, your kung fu is pretty good for non-Chinese. You know, and so, and I will tell you, one of the most surreal and personal things that happened to me in the genre was I'd always wanted to work with Jackie Chan, and actually how I met Jackie Chan was when I first came to Los Angeles, I would write a bunch of, like, actors, you know, and ask them how to get into movies. Like, I would write Brandon Lee, I would write Shoko Kasugi, Cynthia Rothrock, and actually Shoko Kasugi was the first person to respond to me. He actually responded to me, wrote me a letter, he gave me a couple of calls. But Jackie Chan actually sent me, he was making, he had already filmed Armor of Guard 2, and he actually sent me this big book and sent me a letter basically saying he saw my demo, thought I had talent. If I ever come to Hong Kong, give him a call. I went to Hong Kong, gave him a call. We went down and, you know, we went and saw him, and, you know, I got to meet Jackie Chan. So what happened was, I want to say it was about 5 years later, Jackie was here doing Rush Hour. And Philip Tan, who was a friend of mine, he was working on Rush Hour, and he actually called me down to the set. So I went down to the set to see Jackie, and I was like, hey, Jackie, you know, how you doing? He's like, oh, Ron, you know, you remember me, we talked a little bit. And then when I got him to the side, I said, okay, Jackie, you're in the States now. When are we going to work together? And he kind of looked at his, he had his assistant with him. So he kind of looked at his assistant, and he rolled his eyes, and he said, okay, you have a demo? And I said, yeah. He said, go get your demo and let me see it. So I ran, and I got my demo, and I ran over to him. And when I gave it to him, he kind of rolled his eyes and he kind of dropped it in a little bag that his assistant was holding, like, okay, you know, let me throw this in a circular file. Jeez. So, you know, so the next day when I came back, his stunt team were walking towards me and they were like, oh, they like pointing at me, going, oh, you're the black guy, we saw your kung fu. And, what's his name? Ken Lo actually walked up to me and said, oh, man, your kicks are really good. So I was, you know, happy about that. And Jackie, I was standing in a circle of stuntmen. And I think it was Vic Armstrong, James Liu, Jeff Amata, you know, a bunch of like top stuntmen who were working on Rush Hour at that time. And we were standing in there and Jackie was drinking a Coke and he had run through the crowd and he ran over to me. He said, Ron, I've seen thousands of people all over the world. He said, you are the most talented person I've seen. You got talent. And I was like, wow. Like Jackie Chan said that to me. I even called my mom. I'm like, Mom, Jackie Chan told me he thought I was the most talented person he ever saw. And he actually said we were going to work together, but we never worked together. So, you know.
You ever get the feeling he may have said that to other people before?
Well, I'm sure, you know, I'll put it like this. It's like, if anybody looks at my work, you can see that I have the ability to entertain. This is what I call it, an ability to entertain you while fighting in a cinematic context, meaning that that's what the fighting is for. It's like, yeah, I'm a martial artist. I can defend myself. I've actually had people challenge me on movie sets and have had to defend myself.
Really?
But yeah, several times. I'll tell you about one of the stories later, which is pretty amusing. But what I know that I can do almost every time is I can entertain you by fighting, meaning that you can. And most of the fights that I've done in movies have been probably about an hour long, meaning that usually they will set up the fight. They will shoot everything around it for about 10 hours, and then they go, okay, Ron, the sun's getting ready to go down. We're out of film. The people got to go home. We're going to lose the location. Go. And then I have to jump through my butt and pull out something in about an hour. So that's pretty much how most of the fights that you've seen in my films have gone. So about fighting and about someone trying to fight me on set, I was doing a movie with Richard Grieco called Sinbad and the Battle of the Dark Knights. And what happened, one of the security guards, you know, he was kind of mocking me going, oh, black karateka. You know, he was doing like, and he was like, I want to challenge you. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna, you know, I was like, I'm not going to challenge you, man. You know, I'm here working, you know, we're working on a film. He's like, no, I want to challenge you. I said, okay, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's just do some movements. And then whatever you do, you know, I'll do it. And then we'll just see what comes out of that. So he broke out and did like karate move number one, you know, and I just did like a form, like maybe about 10 seconds of really hard, fast movements. And, you know, and then his friends kind of got like intimidated. They were like, man, don't fight this guy. Right. So later on that evening, about 3 o'clock, we had been shooting all day. So it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And, I was sleeping in my trailer, and there were some kids who had seen my movies. They were hanging out with me during the whole shoot. They knocked on the door. They were like, Ron. I'm like, what? They were, Ron, these guys are here, and they're here to challenge you. And I was like, what? And I was tired sleeping. But I came out of my dressing room, and I went outside. It was probably about 12 guys, and they were all standing there. It was kind of like a scene out of Heroes of the East. They were just standing there, and they were waiting for me. Some of them had karate uniforms. Some of them had, like, gym uniforms, whatever. And I want to say probably – it had to be over 50 people there because it was a big scene that we were shooting with a crowd. So they were like, oh, you know, you embarrassed our guy and you bullied him. So we're here to challenge you. And I'm like, challenge me in what? They're like, we want to fight you. I'm like, I'm not going to fight you guys. You know, we're working. I said, but, you know, I can do the same thing with you guys that I did with him. You know, whatever you want to do, you know, I'll just do it and we can challenge each other this way. So they had a guy who was kind of like, you know, he was the good puncher. So our thing was, he would try to punch at me, and I'd block his punches, but then he couldn't block my punches. Then they had another guy who was the guy, you know, he was warming up doing the splits, and I just jumped into my splits forward and sideways. And then another guy who, you know, he was supposed to be like an acrobatic guy, but I out-acrobatic this guy. But one of the funniest parts was there was a really muscular guy. I mean, I would say if you took Bruce Lee and Van Damme and popped him into one guy, that's what this guy looked like. And he looked like Tong Po from Kickboxer. And so what happened was he came over there. He took off his shirt. He had this big old muscular, greasy body that he was showing off. And he was like, he's wanted to challenge me to some push-ups. So all the kids kind of looked at me like, uh-oh. Like, this guy is definitely going to beat Ron. Ron's not going to be able to out-push-up this guy. So the guy, he gets on the ground, and he does probably about 100 push-ups. And so when he got up, everybody looked at me. And I stood there for a second, and I laid on the ground, and people were looking at me, wondering what I'm doing. Then I told him to stand on my back, and I did 50 with him standing on my back.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, and then after that, they actually came by another day, and they brought me some food, and they brought me a little Arabic outfit, and they were actually pretty cool. So, yeah.
Very nice.
This was filmed in Jordan, according to the IMDb. Is that true?
Yeah, that was in Jordan. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's very unique.
What can you give us your experiences about working on Orgasmo?
Well, Orgasmo was very interesting. That was Trey and Matt's. I don't know if it was their second film. I think it was their second film.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, their second one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just very, you know, just a very quick, fast project that, you know, they wanted to do this crazy thing and insert some martial arts in it. But, you know, I actually got to know Trey and Matt pretty well, and they were very cool guys and they were very ambitious. I think at that time they were making South Park Christmas cards that they were sending out. They were like these little cards with these characters. I want to say, I think they were Christmas cards, but they were these little cards with these characters that they were sending out. The rest is history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of their funniest movies, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that and the other one. What's the other one, John?
There's Team America. There's
Team America, that's it.
Yeah, Cannibal the Musical was their first film, which I thought was...
I wasn't too fond of that one.
Yeah, it's actually filmed around here. So it was like their student film that they sold to Troma. Yeah. But but also with Vampire Assassin, Ron, were you pleased with how it came out? Did you have total control on that film, or because I know that was pretty big in the rental scene for a little while back when they were still renting DVDs.
No, Vampire Assassin was a very, you know, for lack of a better word, horrible experience. You know, imagine. Okay, I'll give an example. Imagining trying to make a martial art movie where no martial artist wants to lose. So for example, let's just say you're getting people to put in your movie and everyone wants to be like the lead guy, meaning that if you tell somebody to take a punch, they don't want to take a punch, they don't want to react. And essentially what I would have to do is try to design my action. I would just let people do whatever they want, and then I would have to design the action around it. But Vampire Assassin was a movie I wrote, directed. You know, did the catering, made the costumes. I don't advise anybody to do this, but, you know, it was a very, you know, difficult experience. And I really had no control over the movie in terms of putting it together, editing it. And it was funny is I watched it a couple of months ago, and there's a special effect in it that if you saw it, I don't know, there's a bat. The vampire turns into a bat. And the special effect is made in After Effects. However, it probably would have been more convincing had we taken a rubber bat, stuck it on a string, and dangled it in front of the camera.
That's how it is with a lot of CGI stuff I've seen. I often figure they would be better off with puppets or men in suits and stuff than what they do with these little cartoon characters, you know, made from a computer. So it's I get in a way your movie was a preview of what was to come. With kind of inferior effects just to be shown. Well, it is post-production CGI, which I'm guessing that's what it was. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, you know, Vampire Assassin actually, there's this dynamic that a lot of martial art guys I go through, I know, we talk about this all the time. And what ends up happening is when you're a fight choreographer or martial art talent, that is working in films and you're not like top level, meaning that you're not somebody who's at the top, but you're somebody who's trying to get there.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks they know more about martial arts and film than you do. They think you're just the karate guy who gets in front of the camera and does some moves. And then what they want to do is they want to take what you did and now they're going to make it fantastic. Well, any fight choreographer who's ever choreographed anything always knows that you mentally plan what you want to shoot before you do it. You know what you want it to look like. You know the things that you want to emphasize and highlight. And you try to make allowances for those things when you're shooting. Now, if I were to shoot my footage and then give it to you to edit, if you just look at the footage, you probably will not do as good of a job if you were to edit the footage with my input.
Right.
And if you talk to anybody who ever worked in a martial art movie, they would probably, the thing that they complain about the most is the editing. Because the editing is in control of the pacing, the timing, the impact, the power, how you see it, how it plays. And it's really probably one of the most important aspects of martial art action filmmaking. Right. But what ends up happening is that you can collaborate with people and they just want you to do the action, and then they go and take, you know, take your action and just put it in a way that it will won't even have the same meaning that you gave it when you created the action.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, when you watch, like, say, Sammo Hung films from the 80s, they're, like, perfectly edited fight scenes. And I always wonder, was Sammo in the editing room with the editor, or the editors just know what to do, you know, working for Golden Harvest and dealing with that type of filmmaking? Because if you watch something like Eastern Condors, like, the editing is flawless on the fight scenes.
Well, not only that, but Asian filmmaking has a simpatico that American filmmaking is learning now, meaning that when you make a movie in Asia, the director, the producer, the writer, the editor, the fight choreographer, they're all in tune with trying to make the action excel. Like, that's their purpose. Their purpose is, we want to make the act. Does this look, you know, amazing? Is it fun? Is it powerful? Is it fast? Whereas you can work on an American film and somebody will put a camera down and expect two people to do 200 moves before you cut. That's a huge difference in film. This is, and the difference is I'll give you an example. If you look at the work that Jackie Chan and Jet Li did in Hong Kong and the work that they did here, there is no comparison. There's no comparison.
Nah.
Work they did in Asia, even though bigger, more money, better production budget, you know, better stories, arguably, but definitely the action that they did in Hong Kong is on a different level than it is in the United States.
It's more of a hands-on, do-it-yourself approach to the ones in Hong Kong than in America, where it's all... I'm not too sure, but are the film crews in Hong Kong union at all, or is it non-union?
I really don't know. I really couldn't tell you because, you know, like I said, I never worked in Hong Kong. I always worked like in the Philippines and in the States.
John, do you have any clue for the union over in?
I don't. I'm not aware of any sort of production union.
Yeah, I think that's the difference, because over in the US, it's mostly union. So therefore, it's you can't do this. This person has to do this, and it's just too many fingers in the pie, basically.
Because I've noticed, like, when I'd watch the old films with commentary, and it'll be pointed out that Yen Biu will be doubling the character he's fighting. Like, he'll be doubling Frankie Chan when Frankie Chan's getting hit and does a backflip, and somebody's doubling Yen Biu's character in The Prodigal Son. Or Yen Biu is doubling for Cynthia Rothrock in Righting Wrongs, and is also the lead actor in the
film.
How
the hell do you double for Cynthia Rothrock?
They put a blonde wig on him, and he just does the flip. He does the acrobatics she can't do, and if you slow it down, you can see Yen Biu doing these flips off of a table and stuff. It's crazy. And wearing padding, padded bra and everything.
Yeah, if you watch a lot of Hong Kong movies, Cindy had many doubles, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, she's had many doubles, but, you know, it doesn't take away from her talent, but she's, you know.
No, not at all. She's great with a bow staff when she does, like, her bow form or whatever. It's amazing. It's just, like, if you watch Yes, Madam, it's enough of that in there that's her that it's, like, it's stunning. And it was jaw-dropping at the time when we were passing around bootleg tapes.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting? What is interesting now is that Hong Kong is essentially taking the Hong Kong aesthetic, incorporated it into Hollywood movies, and kind of gotten rid of the Hong Kong people, kind of. So now we just have Westerners doing Hong Kong-like action. And, you know, there are other things that come with martial art movies, meaning the philosophy of martial arts. I mean, there are a lot of martial art movies that have wonderful stories about martial arts, you know, stories about wonderful characters and their pursuit of martial arts, about the philosophy of martial arts, about how martial arts can help you develop yourself, change your environment, change your world, you know, and yet the use of martial arts in American movies is primarily exploitation, in the terms that we just want to fight to kick your butt. That's the only end of knowing martial arts.
Yeah, I've always said it, put it this way. I said over in Asia, it's a way of life. Over here in our movies, it's James Bond's briefcase with all the gadgets. It's basically a weapon to use. It's not any sort of lifestyle or influence in that aspect. Like, I don't know when if we'll ever see like a American director who can be like a Liu Jialiang or some of these other filmmakers who blow me away when they do like the real personal martial arts movies that most people over here in America haven't seen, which is unfortunate. Right. We have the Karate Kid, and that's about it. It's not a lot.
So you basically have nothing really if you count the Karate Kid.
Right. The Last Dragon, in a way, sort of. You know?
Yeah. I mean, if you look, you know, the Karate Kid is actually a ripoff of, you know, like Challenge of the Masters. It's basically,
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It even uses the training gimmick from Return to the 36th Chamber, where he's working and not realizing he's learning a martial art. He's just doing all this labor and then suddenly realizes he's got this ability because he was doing this repetitious labor that was really fighting training in disguise. So it's like there's a lot of stuff swiped. And I think the screenwriter of Karate Kid has admitted he steals from Hong Kong movies all the time. He goes, oh, I watch them all the time. They're great to steal from. Like he admits
it. Well, you can definitely see that in his work. So, yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah.
You know what? I'll tell you, here's a really difference between, like, American movies and Hong Kong movies is, if you take the movie, what was the movie with Jet Li and Jackie Chan in?
Forbidden Kingdom.
Forbidden Kingdom. Now, just imagine had that same movie been made in Hong Kong by complete Hong Kong filmmakers. You know how awesome that movie would have been?
Yeah.
With Jet Li and Jackie Chan in the same movie? It just would have been incredible. You know, except
the only problem is it would have had Canto Pop songs that would have been cut out in the American release and musical numbers. And, you know, the way they make stuff, it's I remember when they were hyping up Operation Condor under the title Project Eagle. And they were like, this is Jackie's real big shot at American theatrical release. And then when the film came out, it was so Chinese. Like, it had Cantopop tunes and musical numbers and just really goofy, crazy stuff. And half the film seemed improvised. I'm like, there was no – they gave up on that American dream, I think, halfway through filming this, if they even were thinking it in the first place. And it subsequently was called Operation Condor, Armor of God 2. Over here, it's just called – it's called something like Operation Condor, Armor of the God or something. And they cut out all the comedy and all the very Chinese elements, which makes it viewing it an even weirder experience. So it's you know, that's the problem, I think, with Hong Kong filmmaking at the time. If they were trying to pander to Western taste, they would cut out too much of what made their stuff unique. Like, if you see – have you ever seen Ronnie Yu's China White?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like there's nothing, very little in it except for like one glass stunt that would even tell you it was made by a Hong Kong director. It's like they were afraid. They wanted it to look like something that Canon Films would have made straight to video or something. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, but, but Hong Kong, I mean, I'll put like the, you know, one movie that actually is one of my, it's not – okay, I'll put it like this. Rumble in the Bronx to me is a very interesting Jackie Chan movie because while it's not Jackie Chan's best movie, it is a good, I guess, mixture of everything Jackie Chan does well. Like that fight that he had in the pool hall with those guys. Like that was – to me, that is – especially the Hong Kong version that has the Hong Kong music.
I was going to bring that up actually about Rumble in the Bronx because the one I saw has only ever been the off the Hong Kong Laserdisc, the much longer edition, which is about 20 minutes longer, I believe. And I did watch the American one once, or the international cut, and it was terrible. I couldn't watch it again.
Yeah, it's too soft. It's too, like, they edit it to, I mean, Jackie's funny, but he also has an edge, you know, to him too. But, the way they cut it, you know, in the American version is, again, another example of not understanding the appeal for martial art movies. And, you know, people that have been watching these movies, you know, for 10, 20 years, their standard is very, you know, their taste and standard is very different as opposed to someone who's just being introduced to it by way of, like, Power Rangers or something.
Right. Yeah. Iron Monkey or Ip Man. I guess Ip Man's probably the most popular Chinese kung fu import. You know, it's basically mainland propaganda, but that's like the most well-known imported kung fu film probably the last 10 years, which is unfortunate. I don't think it's that great, but I think people would be better off watching The Final Master, which came out earlier this year in a limited release, assuming will be on DVD or Blu-ray soon. But I thought that was more of a throwback to what I liked about the old Hong Kong kung fu films, and I hadn't seen anything like that in a mainland movie in quite some time.
Yeah, The Final Master, I actually think, is an evolution in martial art movies. It has a very strong story, has a very compelling lead character. It has just the fight scenes are innovative. I mean, they're really innovative in how they take a dose of reality in terms of, like, the close fighting with the blades. And, you know, even, like, how he fought the people. What's interesting is how he fought the people is almost like a samurai movie where he didn't fight a gang of people at once. It was, you know, very individualistic fighting one person at a time. And just the techniques in there were just incredible. And, yeah, I think that's an evolution. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I had discussed this with Ron Van Cleef when I'd sent him a copy of The Grandmaster, the Wong Kar-wai Wing Chun drama. And I said, you know, and I really felt it when I watched The Final Master. It's one of those movies where every move means something. Like, there's some emotion in every move he's doing, in every fight. Like, it actually has meaning instead of being a stunt show like it is with a lot of martial arts movies where they just throw it in there.
Yeah. Yep, I can't wait to see what the director of that movie is doing next, because Final Master is really just, to me, it's my favorite martial art movies of the 2000s, easily.
Definitely. It's in my top 10. I was blown away. I was like, wow. And you had put it to my attention, because you had posted on social media about it, and I found out it was like, playing at some theater here in North Denver, all halfway to Boulder. One theater was showing it, and limited screenings. And I went and saw it, caught it one Sunday morning, was blown away. I was just like, yes, this is what I want to see.
I think The Final Mask, I think anyone who's interested in or a fan of martial art movies will definitely get something out of watching The Final Master. It just has so many good things in it that, you know, and even the story, the way the story, you know, the story has like this art house structure. It's not structured like a traditional martial art movie, you know.
Right.
It's not even structured like a, you know, like a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's a very subdued, nuanced kind of storytelling. And then they have these amazing, you know, the ending. No way watching that movie did you think that type of ending was coming.
No, I did not. I actually thought it was going to end like 30 minutes earlier. And I said, oh, I guess we're going to take the subtle artsy route. And then they had that big fight at the end, and that stuff, it just blew me away. I was like, wow, it's like watching Marshall Club or one of my old favorite classics, like Legend of a Fighter or Prodigal Son, you know, in the old days. I said, this must have been what it was like watching that stuff in Chinatown back in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
All right, no, I was gonna ask you about Kung Fu Brother, because I've been hearing all these rumors about what happened with that film, and if you want to explain that that scenario.
Well, I guess the best way to explain Kung Fu Brother is there's a poster with me on it that came out a few years ago that you see with me clearly on it, and then it ends up being a poster with the guy who directed the movie and does not know any martial arts whatsoever doing a martial art pose, and he's on the poster.
Yikes.
And so, you know, that, you know, Kung Fu Brother was a movie that we did back in, I want to say, 2005. Mm-hmm. It was called Almost Related, a title I'd never really enjoyed to be politically correct. I'd say I'd never enjoyed that title. And basically, it was about two guys going to Thailand, and I played a Thai cop, which, you know, just was interesting to me that, you know, I had an American accent. You know, it was just an interesting mixture of all these things. But, you know, some of the action with, I actually am pretty pleased with. I mean, there's a scene in there where I fight a girl with one hand that I really like that fight, even though I don't like the way it's edited, and maybe the sound effects could be a little bit more complimentary. I still like the fight. And, you know, but, you know, it's just another movie in terms of, you know, You know, I was like,
that's enough about that, I think he means.
Well, I will say one thing about Kung Fu Brother is a lot of times people will want me to work on a project with them. And this has kind of been a through line through my career is that, you know, I'm a fan of martial art movies. And my priority is I want to make action that's entertaining. That's my appeal to martial art movies, is that I really want to entertain people. I want you to see it. I want you to, meaning that how I try to present the action is, even if you're a martial artist, I try to present it that I may be a martial artist, but I don't know if I could do that. You know, to try to put like things in there that are just not common. There's something interesting that's going on now with the YouTube phenomenon, which is it's almost kind of like if you remember in the early 70s when they had all these independent, nondescript martial art movies where they did like the swingy arm fighting where there was no distinct kung fu style.
Right.
There's something like that going on today. And what it is you have people who have watched movies for years and they basically know maybe four or five kicks and three or four punches, and they will do a combination of these things to do fight sequences. Now, and it's almost like a modern equivalent to swingy arm kung fu, where there's no distinction in the martial art. There's no distinction in the character of the people's fighting. There's no climax. There's just two people that go at it, and they just swing their arms, and they kick, and they move, and they kick, and they move, and the fight has very little texture to it. Now, on the positive end of that, you have people like, I would say, like Eric Jacobus. You have, you have Mike Moeller. You have, you have some emerging martial artists that truly are as talented as any of the great people who have been in film. You know, I think Eric Jacobus is America's true version of a Jackie Chan. I really believe that. When I look at him, he owns his movement. The way he moves, his nuances, the way he steps, his rhythm, how he changes things, how his fights are innovative. And as you're watching them, they elevate and escalate. So I think he's a true talent. But like I said, on the other end of that, you have people who get together and they got a video camera and, you know, they just swing their arm and they kick their legs and they call it a fight scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Curiously, you had once mentioned that I think Raw Target was one of the films that you've done that you actually enjoy quite a bit. Any stories about that one? I've never seen it myself.
A story about Raw Target. One story was we were filming a scene. There was a scene where me and Dale jumped off a building and landed in a truck. And while we were standing there shooting, preparing for a scene, a dead body floated up that had chains and sticks. And I guess somebody had been roped up or raveled up and dumped in wherever we were standing. And the dead body floated up to the surface of where we were.
Was that shot in the Philippines?
That was shot. Was it Philippines or Thailand? That was Philippines, I believe. Okay. No, maybe. Wait, you know what? Yeah, it was Philippines. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, Philippines. So it may have been Duterte, or our friend, the president of the Philippines, might have been at work very early in those days. Jeez, that is nuts. But
Rodrigo.
Yeah, Rodrigo would get an early jump on the competition there.
Definitely.
But yeah, that I just noticed it is available to watch on Prime Video if you have Amazon Prime for those listeners that have that. So take a look at Raw Target. You can see Ron in action with Dale Cook.
I would say my favorite film of all my work is a movie, is Triple Impact. I just like Triple Impact is just fun. It's light. It's silly. You know? Yeah, I just enjoy it. Yeah.
What I like about Triple Impact is it's such a basic, fun story. It's like a 1940s, road picture mixed with like an action film. And I think you could probably redo that script now and still make a really fun movie. I think that's actually real fun, basic thing, which just gets to the root of a fun film. You know, and I'm a big fan of 40s escapism films like, The Road Pictures and Charlie Chan. I like that basic formula there. And you guys are having fun. It doesn't look like anybody's having a miserable time. Like sometimes when I watch sometimes you'll watch a Jeff Wincott movie and wonder if he was getting along with the lead actress or something. And so,
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Well, you were in Deadly Bet. Wasn't that Wincott's first film?
That was his first film and my first film. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So, do you have any memories from that one? Because I know I rented it years ago, and I'm of course in my mind it mixes up with Don Wilson movies like Ring of Fire that I would see at the same time. So I'm trying to remember. Was that the one with the girl from Dallas, Charlene Tilton?
Yeah, Charlene Tilton. Yeah.
Okay.
Deadly Bet was a time, in the early '90s when I first moved to California. It was like they were making loads of kickboxing movies. Like you can go to AFM and it would be 50 kickboxing movies. You know, Kickboxer's Brother, Kickboxer's Father, kickboxing, and it was just as long as it had kickboxing in it. And You know, what I hated about those movies and making them, like I said, is that I wanted to do the type of stuff I saw Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, and Jet Li do. And people are like, no, you can't do that. You have to do like a John Wayne variation of martial art fighting.
Right.
You know, big haymakers, wide kicks. Let's shoot it all in a master shot. Let's not emphasize anything.
Yeah.
And it was,
I had once described that type of action to people, and I think Damon Foster had first coined this, but it was like, you hit me, now I hit you choreography. Like, let's take turns throwing a kick and then a punch, you know. It's like, it looks like one-step sparring when you take a Taekwondo class. You know, it's just very basic.
No, you know, so that's so accurate because I can remember hearing that phrase no less than 100 times. You know, doing a movie. You hit me, I hit you. Yeah.
Right, right. And, I remember thinking, when were they going to start stealing what I know these guys were watching in Hong Kong films? That took a little while, but yeah, it did happen. Now, your personal, like, okay, I'll run a couple of names. You tell me if you've met these guys. This is for, like, the hardcore Hong Kong movie fans. Yasuaki Kurata.
No.
Okay. Cao Fei.
Yes.
Okay. Any opinions of Cao Fei? He looks like he's a pretty, quite an entrepreneur when it comes to filmmaking. He's directed a lot of movies and starred.
Well, you know what? In the martial art movie genre, you know, we have the celebrated people, kind of like, you know, Jackie Chan, Jet Li, Bruce Lee. But there are really some really phenomenal martial artists that really don't get their due, and Cao Fei is probably at the top of that list. This guy, if you look at his work, like working the deadly the bloody tattoo, the challenger, Legend of a Fighter. He was incredible. I mean, his stances, his movement, his movement was incredible. And I was, I had an opportunity to work with him and I didn't do it and I regret it. I was actually in the Philippines making, I think it was Double Blast with like Linda Blair and Dale Cook. And, Lau Ga Lung's brother, Lau Ga Wing, was producing a movie in the Philippines. Or maybe he was producing it and directing it. I'm not sure. But I actually went to meet with him, and Cao Fei was actually there too. And on the set, when I saw Cao Fei, I mean, he was a young looking guy. He looked vibrant and he was choreographing the scene. And I was like, wow, like, you know. I mean, just to be able to interact with those guys is pretty, you know, growing up watching martial art movies and then you interact with these guys is pretty an amazing experience.
Wow.
And I didn't work on that. My rep at the time would not let me work on that movie because they were paying so little. But I really wished I would have worked with him because he really is a great, you know, there are a couple of guys, like I'll put him in a class with like him, Wilson Tong, John Chung, who else would be in that class? There were just some martial art guys. Lung Gai Yen. These guys really were as talented as anybody in martial art movies. They just weren't the A-list guys.
Right. They didn't have the budgets that they were given out at. Shaw Brothers or Golden Harvest.
Yeah, or even the exposure, but their work is, I mean, phenomenal. I mean, just, you know, Wilson Tong, I mean, oh my God, that guy was incredibly talented. And what's funny is I look at him being so talented, then I look at the character he played in Enter the Dragon. It's like, you don't see any of that reflected in that character in Enter the Dragon.
Right.
The skill that he had, he really was just, and he was all, you know, he was one of the first guys that actually was in the movies and directing them at the same time.
Jeez. Let me think of another name. Yukari Oshima.
Dido. Oh, yeah. Dido's another person that, what's interesting about her is she's a very feminine woman. Like, from watching her movies, they kind of, butcher up a little bit. Like, you know, she's the tough guy. But she actually, when I met her through Sophia Crawford. I was in the Philippines doing a movie, and Sophia and her, they were doing a movie. Mm-hmm. And, we had all gotten together. And I was really surprised about how feminine she was. She was literally like a college chick giggling all the time. And it was just pretty fascinating to me. And somebody who could kick so much ass on screen so incredibly was just a regular, giddy young girl. Yeah.
Girly girl, basically. And in the movies, they make her like a mean lesbian or just really ill-tempered, you know, woman. And yeah, at an interview, really, she always seems nice.
And, you know, and she really was one. She really just was a top talent. I mean, you know, movies like, you look movies like Book of Heroes, Angel. I mean, she, you know, Outlaw Brothers. She
definitely
really
Outlaw
was,
Brothers. Yeah.
You know, she really just on screen, she just had that magic when it came to action. She really was one of the, you know, a lot of women that they put in martial art movies can't sell all of it. She was a person that could sell all of it. She, her pop, you know, their punches, her kicks, her reactions, you know, she was really a very powerful screen presence. And
Do you know, Ron, she trained at Sonny Chiba's Japan Action Club?
No, I do not know that at all.
Yeah, because yeah. I know she started in Bioman, the one of the Sentai shows, and I know a lot of those actors would go through the JAC training program and you know, learn the stunt work and everything. So she would be the last great Sonny Chiba graduate, I think, if that were the case. But you know, we'll list that as unconfirmed right now. So,
I just want to ask, Ron, what are your thoughts on a guy like a modern day martial artist like Michael Jai White?
Well, Michael's. I'll put it like this. I think Michael Jai White is a very good actor, and he's actually a very good martial artist. I wish that Michael would make more, you know, more martial art fare. You know, the movies that he make are kind of like action films with some martial arts in it. But I think Mike has, if you look at Black Dynamite, I think there's a section in a trailer, and he's doing like a kung fu scene where he's kind of like got on a old style kung fu uniform and he's kicking some guys around.
Yeah.
Mike is really an incredible kicker. I mean, he really is an incredible kicker. And I wish that he would do projects to show that prowess on screen. Because you don't really get to see his incredible kicking on screen. You get to see him pose as an incredible kicker. But in terms of him doing it and showing, I mean, there's one kick that he can do, like he jumps up in the air and he kind of like kicks four or five times. It's a variation of what Donnie Yen does all the time. He just does it better.
Okay.
But you never see him do it like in a movie. So, yeah.
Okay.
But no, Mike's a talented guy. He's a handsome guy. He's a good actor. So, yeah.
He just wastes himself in films like Spawn, right?
Well, I mean, that probably was a good opportunity for him, you know, so who wouldn't take that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, actually, Michael Jai White, actually, in doing Bloodsport 2, Michael Jai White, well, in the initial inception of Bloodsport 2, it actually was supposed to be like me and Daniel go to the Kumite. But then, you know, some things happened and I left the project and, you know, Daniel was still attached to the project. And so they had actually cast Michael Jai White in my role. Yeah. And then, but then Michael Jai White ended up getting the Mike Tyson movie and didn't do Bloodsport 2. And I can remember I had to go a re-audition in front of Isaac Florentine. And I can remember Isaac Florentine, he didn't want me in Bloodsport 2 because he thought I was too short to fight Daniel.
You know, there's always that Black Dynamite 2 film they're proposing. You can always get yourself into that as the bad guy against Michael.
Oh, yeah. No, that would be great.
Good martial arts there.
Yep.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
Oh, definitely.
All right, John, you got anything else?
I cover all the basics. And anybody else that you can tell us about, Ron, or any future projects that you're working on that you can reveal anything to the listeners?
Well, where I am is, you know, my goal is I want to make a martial art movie where the concept of the movie is as exciting as the action.
Yeah.
You know, one thing martial art movies suffer from is that, you know, just poor storytelling. And I mean, there are
tournament of death.
You know, there are wonderful, many wonderful martial art movies with great stories and wonderful action. And I think, like I said, that's one reason why I love The Final Master so much, because I think that The Final Master points a direction of the martial art movies. I mean, you know, for years working in martial art movies, you hear people tell you about how martial arts isn't viable as its own thing. Let's combine martial arts with guns. Let's combine it with boxing. But martial arts have been in, you know, in cinema as we know it for like 40 years, and it shows no sign of slowing down.
Yeah.
So I think what's interesting is much of the talent that is in martial art movies actually goes to Hollywood and makes big Hollywood productions that actually kind of work against martial art movies, as opposed to building the genre. I mean, if you think about it now, we really don't have, aside of Scott Adkins, who's the other American guy making martial art movies on a regular basis? And yeah. Scott's not even American. Scott's, you know, from England. But I'm just saying, right. You know, we don't have, like, a genre where you have a group of actors. You know, we don't have anything like an equivalent of a Five Deadly Venoms, or maybe, like, you know, a couple of different actors who are making films. You rarely do you see a phenomenal bad guy being, you know, matched up against, you know, whoever the lead is. You know, the bad guy is usually just serviceable.
Yeah.
Right. So, it seems like whenever they try to make something, like the Kickboxer remake, apparently was just a financial disaster that they ran out of money, and then it was reshot with a different choreographer or something, or finished with a different choreographer. That thing was just, it's a crazy, the legal mess behind the Kickboxer remake is more interesting than the actual movie probably is.
The original Kickboxer itself has got issues for the fact that there's various versions floating around, and has been for many years. Mm-hmm. Trying to find one complete uncut version of that film is a nightmare.
Hmm. Well, I had heard it was originally going to be shot with a different actor playing Tong Po. That Harold Diamond, who is Stallone's stick-fighting opponent in Rambo 3, was originally cast as Tong Po and then replaced. So, and then Harold Diamond was the one they called in to help finish the Kickboxer remake. So it is a crazy, weird story. I never cared much for the film. I thought the fighting was too basic.
I'd love to get somebody actually associated with that film to sort of give some clarity about what the hell is actually going on, because myself and my friend have just been getting various versions, and there's some scenes cut here for this version and in some other ones inserted here. It's like, what is the full running time of this thing? It's just crazy. I think we've given up after the Blu-rays. Like, it's still cut, so just screw it. No more. I'm not being bothered. But one thing I need to ask you, Ryan, before we finish up, going to do the desert island question. You've got to take five films with you that you just simply couldn't live without. What are they? In no particular order, but what are the five films you just got to have with you?
Are you talking about martial art films or just any movie at all?
Any ones you want.
Okay. Well, Battle Royale would definitely be one.
Oh, nice. not the Hunger Games? Not the Hunger Games?
No.
It's hard. Yeah, I know.
It's like, yeah. Okay. The Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. Okay.
Silmido. Let's see. Two more movies. Wow. Heroes of the East.
Yeah, I'd agree.
And, oh my God, I got to put a Jackie Chan in there. Let's see. A Jackie movie. If I had to take one Jackie movie, oh my God. No, I probably would. You know what? I'd have to put Game of Death before Jackie movie. So I'd Game of Death.
Game of Death? Okay.
Let me tell you what. Yeah. I'm talking about the first one that was released. I love that Game of Death, even though they got the Bruce Lee imitators. And one thing I love about Game of Death is that it's really, like, if you look at Bruce Lee's films, his four the four movies that he made, the evolution in his fighting in the movies is really, like, amazing in a two-year period. I mean, if you look at how he was fighting in Fist of Fury and how he was fighting in Game of Death, I mean, Game of Death literally is the fighting that we are working to get to now, where it's kind of, it's modern, but it's stylistic and it's evolving. And if you could see, you know, I'll put it like this, the fight where he fought the guy on the second floor, how do you pronounce his name?
Jihan Jai or something like that.
Yeah, that is my favorite Bruce Lee fight of all time. I love that fight. That fight has so much energy, and it's basically Jeet Kune Do as expressed by Bruce Lee. It's like, it's, you know, it's not like he's standing off. It's all the normal tropes of a martial art action film fight are not in that fight. That fight has something else going on, and that's my favorite Bruce Lee fight. I just love it.
It's so ironic because I was talking to my brother on Saturday night, and he was waxing lyrical about Game of Death. I said, nah, I don't get it. He goes, Stuart, you're missing out. He goes, you got to watch it again. He goes, the fights in that film is just insane.
Yeah. Well, even I was even the guy who was imitating Bruce Lee. There's a fight where he fought the guys in the courtyard. I love that fight. And not only that, but the music of Game of Death is so great and so perfect. It's just like so – it fits like a glove on that movie.
And Dean Jagger as well.
And Mr. Mel Novak, who's a personal friend of mine and worked with me a couple of times. He's in Game of Death.
Just can you guys clarify for me quickly, who was it who fought Kareem in that film? Was it Bruce Lee or was it these –
It's Bruce Lee. It's Bruce.
Yeah.
Kareem would have nothing to do with the Golden Harvest reshoots they were doing in 77 to complete the film. He wanted nothing to do with the film, and I think they threw some money at him. He wouldn't do it. So that is the Bruce Kareem footage. You're not seeing all of it. There's a lot of footage on Warrior's Journey, and I think the Japanese it's sort of like a docudrama art. Help me out here, Ron. Do you remember this? It's like Bruce's G.O.D., Bruce Lee and G.O.D. or something. It's a Japanese production that Bay Logan cooperated with. And
oh God,
yeah. It had more of the footage. Like Kareem had like reptile eyes underneath his sunglasses.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's like crazy science fiction stuff. He has like these real crazy reptile lizard eyes that are supposed to be light sensitive and. When his glasses are taken off, and they had these scenes in there, and there's a whole lot more to that than what's in the Robert Klaus version. Robert Klaus didn't like a lot of the footage he saw, but I do love my favorite fight in that film is it's basically Yen Bu and Kim Tae Jung. Bob Wall, and I think even Casanova Wong does the roundhouse kicks on Bob Wall, which I guess Bob Wall goes around saying he did himself to himself. But that fight scene I thought was terrific. Of course, it's all Sammo Hung. But I remember seeing that in the theater when I was a kid, and that was the fight scene we were all cheering. Because when he did the backflip and did the multiple roundhouses, kids were going crazy in that theater.
Hey, Ron, let me ask you, what are your thoughts on a film like Black Belt Jones with Jim Kelly?
Black Belt Jones, let's start with this. First of all, I think Jim Kelly is arguably the best-looking man in movies ever. Just like if you look at that fro and his face, he was just such a handsome guy and he had this presence. But, Black Belt Jones was just, it was kind of fluff. It wasn't really, as a black martial artist, it was important to me to see a black character as a kid. But instantly I could recognize that Jim Kelly was no Bruce Lee. But he had his own unique appeal. And I think he had enough charisma to warrant, a bigger and better career. Yeah. So Black Belt Jones was just, it was okay.
It's like, John, you're not very fond of it, are you?
It's too comedic. I mean, I like Jim Kelly in films. He has a great screen presence. He can rock that afro and you don't laugh at him. That says a lot. He's a cool cat, but the movies, I'm not sure if filmmakers just didn't know what to do with martial arts. In movies back then, well, let's make it a silly comedy. We can't take this seriously. So you can't take the fight seriously if you can't take the movie seriously.
You can't take seriously an Italian mafia getting kicked into a bowl of spaghetti sauce.
Yeah, it's kind of like Three Stooges type action. And Jim didn't have much kicking ability. Like he's obviously doubled for like kicks and stuff. So and I think his style was was hand oriented. It was Okinawan Tay, I think. I might be wrong. But,
and sticking Scatman Crothers in there probably doesn't help with a comedic factor.
I like Scatman Crothers.
Oh, no, I do too, very much so. But I'm saying it doesn't help the fact that it gets more marketed as a comedy, an action comedy.
Yeah, and I think it was Gloria Hendry was in the film.
Gloria Hendry,
I met her years ago, very nice woman. And she's cool in the flick. But something about Bob Klaus and Fred Weintraub, they just can't take – it's like they couldn't take martial arts seriously or – couldn't sell it without Bruce Lee. I don't know what the deal is there.
Well,
they made all these movies.
That's probably what it was. Was if you think about it, I mean, Bruce Lee was the defining element of Enter the Dragon. You know, if you take Bruce Lee out of Enter the Dragon, you don't have much.
Yeah, have much with Bruce Lee. I do not like that film at all. I think it's just boring.
Yeah. What, Enter the Dragon?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
No. I like Way of the Dragon much more.
I've seen Enter the Dragon. I don't know, 500 times maybe.
Oh my goodness.
I'll tell you, man, I'll put it like this. As a kid, when you were watching Bruce Lee movies, this is like Bruce Lee's now in the big leagues. That was like so exciting that, oh my God, this looked like a big Hollywood movie. And it's got like soundtrack music. and it's got Western actors. It was like, as a kid, I'm from Washington, D.C., and they used to show Enter the Dragon and Three the Hard Way, like, all the time.
Three the Hard Way. Telling, I love Three the Hard Way. It's so awesome, that movie.
Man, to me, Three the Hard Way is the holy grail of black exploitation. I always ask people, I say, if you were stuck on a desert island and you had to have two groups of people to rescue you, who would you pick? The Expendables or Three the Hard Way? I don't know about you, but I'd pick Three the Hard Way. They were just so, those guys, man, together, they just had so much charisma. They were cool. They looked good. They each had their own thing. And yeah, Three the Hard Way is just something that I don't think we'll ever get again.
Unless unless we get a Tarantino homage to it with Jamie Foxx and a couple other guys in there probably, but it will definitely not be as good as the original.
No. You have, because those guys each had their own pedigree. It was kind of like the Super Bowl of black exploitation, you know. Let's get the biggest, baddest guys together. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're pretty much done here. Ron, now's your chance to plug any websites or upcoming projects. Anything that you want
to
plug?
No, I don't have anything to plug right now. I will say that, we'll be back. I will be back.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Ron. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Stuart. I enjoy your show. I listen actually to it pretty often. I told John that.
Goodness! And you still listen after all the we tend to go off on tangents and say things that you know.
Oh, that's what I love about it. You can see, I do the same thing, so that's how I can relate. So
all right. Well, I'm impressed because a lot of people will throw hate mail away saying you're a bunch of this and a bunch of that, and I'm going, well, whatever, deal with it, princess. You'll be all right.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Great. Thanks, Ron. Thank you, John, as well.
Thanks, John.
Yes, thank you.
John, thanks, John, for setting all this up. I appreciate it greatly. And plugs for us, the usual website, midnightmoviecowboys.com. Email us, midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Find us on Spreaker, Stitcher, iTunes, I think. We're on Spreaker. We're somewhere anyway. We're out there if you want to find us. And Hunter's back next week, I believe. And that's it. So in the infamous words of Hunter, I'll say adios.
I'll say Megan.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Very much, Ron. Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.